Get that. Now that's magic. Good morning, folks. Welcome to, I think it's our fourth theme talk on finding my religion or finding our religion. I was a little bit disconcerted about the music. Was that Beauty and the Beast?
Yes. Who's who?
Well, according to Nick, and for those who may need a physical description of us, he reckons through the week that we have been Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Now, I don't think we can call you Tweedledum, but we're both white.
Tweedledees.
You're Tweedledee. I'll be Tweedledum. That's thanks to our wonderful musician Nick and his wonderful sense of humour. So, welcome. And just to physically describe us, we're white men. Larger than life and larger probably than the average person here. I think that will do, really. I think that's enough. We have dark hair. Dark hair.
One
a bit shorter than
and
the
actually,
other.
Some people do say that we look like twins, and yeah, I take that.
Well, you're much younger than me, though.
Okay, I can be a son.
You can be a nephew. Shall we call you a nephew? Okay. Yeah. Welcome, everybody. So welcome to this morning's theme talk. Me and Eric are going to be exploring our journey, finding our religion, exploring actually some of the themes that we've been looking at in our engagement group this week. So you may have heard some of it, or you may hear some of it later in the week, those that are in our group. But it's been an interesting week. So let's begin, though, by let's just still ourselves in silence, and let's invite a loving presence to be here amongst us, and to awaken from deep down within us all. And if Ivy could light our chalice flame, please. Thank you. So these are words adapted by Craig Rowland. As we breathe in the warmth of this light, its glow filling the spaces where fear and doubt reside, let us breathe out the tension that we carry to release what no longer serves us. Breathe in the strength of our community, a sanctuary of diverse voices and shared purpose. Breathe out the urge to go it alone. Let us embrace the power of togetherness. Breathe in the courage to speak truth, even when it trembles on our lips. Breathe out the silence that holds us back. Let us make space for honesty and justice. Breathe in the hope of transformation, knowing we are here to build and to heal. Breathe out despair, trusting that change is born in small acts of love. May each breath remind us of the sacred rhythm of life, the pulse of creation, and the power we hold to shape the world around us. Amen. Now, I have a tale to tell, a story to share, and it probably one of my top five favourite stories when I was a little boy, probably about your age, Ezra, or something like that. Just a little bit older than Molly, I think. And Sarah talked about Ladybird books yesterday, I seem to, wasn't that yesterday? And I've come across not only this story, but the one that we had when we were kids in the 1970s. Anybody else have this particular you remember this Chicken Licking? So it was published in 1969, this particular picture, this version. And so I'm going to be telling another version of it, but this one's an even older version than this. And it's anybody heard of Edward Everett Hale? Yeah, you'll know that famous quotation that apparently is one of those classic quotations that's wrongly attributed to him. It's not in his writings. He may have said it. It may have been in a letter, actually, that he sent to his cousin, or it may have been his niece, Helen Keller. And he was a huge, huge influence on Helen's life, apparently, and the family's life. And an incredible man who wrote loads of books, but a collection of children's books as well. So this version is, well, it's just about his version anyway. And I became famous during lockdown. Some of you, oh, well, maybe not famous, but I did a whole series of telling children's stories every day, actually, as a character called Captain Dan. Anybody remember him? One or two of you do, yes. And I don't think I actually did this one. I don't know why. I don't think it was sent. People would send me books in the post, children's stories, and I would basically tell them. They're somewhere on YouTube if you want to find them. But do you want to borrow this? No, that's right. Pass it on to the adults, they might be interested. So, and I need some help with this, actually. I need some help, because I'm very forgetful, so if I forget bits, you need to remind me and tell the story back to me. And maybe if you can guess some of the characters that we meet along the way, see if you can remember the story. Well, wait till we get into the story. Now, Sheila... We like enthusiasm, but that's just a bit too much. Is that a bit of scat? That's why you ended up in the sea, isn't it, that time? Yeah, I know. Anyway, here we go. So, as Chicken Licken was going one day to the wood, whack, an acorn fell from a tree on his head. Gracious goodness me, said Chicken Licken, the sky must have fallen. I must go tell the king. And it works now because we've got a king again, haven't we? So Chicken Licken turned back and he met...
Juicy Lucy?
Not yet, no. And it's not Juicy Lucy. That sounds like somebody you once met there, Alan. Now that's a different version of this story.
It's Juicy Lucy.
Mark, we've not even started, Alan. No, this is going to take a long time. He met...
On
your version, maybe. Yeah. PG, please. No, he met Henny Penny. Henny Penny. Well, Henny Penny, where are you going, said he. I'm going to the wood, said she. Oh, Henny Penny. Don't go, said he, for I was going and the sky fell onto my head. And I'm going to tell the king. Come on, help me. I'm going to tell the king. Thank you. So Henny Penny turned back with Chicken Licken and met... Careful about this one. You're not allowed to speak. Cocky Locky. Well, Cocky Locky. Well, I never realised, actually. This used to be a lovely story. Well, Cocky Locky, where are you going, said he. I'm going to the wood, said he. Then Henny Lenny said to Cocky Locky, don't go, for I was going, and I met Chicken Licken, and Chicken Licken had been at the wood, and the sky had fallen on his head, and we're going to... Thank you. Not see the king, tell the king. Come on, wake up. I know it's early. So Cocky Locky turned back, and they met... Well done, Barbara. You've had your cornflakes, haven't you? Well, Ducky Lucky, where are you going? And Ducky Lucky said, I'm going to the wood. Then Cocky Locky said, oh, Ducky Lucky, don't go. I was going. I met Henny Lenny, and Henny Lenny met Chicken Licken, and Henny Penny. Well, we can identify any way we like, can't we? That's okay. If it wants to be Lenny, it can be Lenny. Or she can be Lenny. I've been to the wood in the sky. Thank you for listening, at least. The sky had fallen on his head, and they go, I told you I forget things, and they're going to tell the king. So Ducky Lucky turned back, and who did they meet? Drakey Lakey. Come on. Well, Drakey Lakey, where are you going? And Drakey Lakey said, I'm going to the wood. Then Ducky Lucky said, oh, Drakey Lakey, don't go, for I was going, and I met Cocky Locky, and Cocky Locky met Henny Penny, get it right, Danny, and Henny Penny met Chicken Licken, and Chicken Licken had been to the wood, and the guy, come on, fallen on his head, and they're going to tell the king. Thank you. So Drakey Lakey turned back and met... Not Juicy, Goosey Lucy Allen. Yes, is that right? Not the one you met.
Goosey Lucid. Well, Goosey Lucid, where are you going? A Goosey Lucid. She said, I'm going to the wood. And Drakey Lakey said, oh, Goosey Lucy, don't go. But I was going, and I met Ducky Lucky, and Ducky Lucky met Cocky Locky, and Cocky Locky met
Henny
Penny, Danny, come on. And Henny Penny met
Chicken
Licky. And Chicken Licky had been at the wood, come on. And what had happened at the wood? And so, thank you, we got that bit right. So, Goosey Lucy, yeah, turned around and met you've been hanging out with Alan. No, he met Gandily Landily. Do you not remember? That's according to Edward Everett Hale's version. Well, Gandily Landily, where are you going? And Gandily Landily said, I'm going to the wood, of course. Then Goosey Lucy said, oh, Gandily, you've got to, I feel like, oh, anyway, don't worry. Gandily Landily, don't go, for I was going and I met Drakey Lakey, and Drakey Lakey met Ducky Lucky, and Ducky Lucky met Cocky Locky, and not yet, Cocky Locky met Henny, Penny, Danny, not Lenny, and Henny Penny met, I've written Lenny here for some reason, Henny Penny met Chicken Licky, and Chicken Licky had been at the wood, and the sky had fallen on his head, and they're all going to tell the king, thank you. So Gandily Landily turned around and met you sound like Nigel Farage. No, sorry, that's too far, isn't it? No, Turkey Lurkey. Come on. Of course, yes, Sarah, you remember now, don't you? Turkey Lurkey. Well, Turkey Lurkey, where are you going? And Turkey Lurkey said, thank you. Then Gandily Landily said, don't go. I was going and met all the others, and they're going to tell the king. So Turkey Lurkey turned back and walked with, let's remember them all, Gandily Landily, Goosey Lucy, Drakey Lakey, Ducky Lucky, Cocky Lucky, Henny Penny, and Chicken Licking. And as they were going along, they met, careful, Foxy Loxy. And this time Foxy Loxy, don't get upset, and this time Foxy Loxy said, where are you going? And they said, well, Chicken Licken went to the wood and the sky fell on his head. And Foxy Loxy said, come along with me, and I will show you the way. But Foxy Loxy was a trickster, and Foxy Loxy took them into his fox hole. And if you read the end of that book, something happened to poor Chicken Licken and Henny Lenny and Cocky Locky and Ducky Lucky and Drakey Lakey and Goosey Lucy even and Gandily Landily and Turkey Lurkey, and they never got to tell the king that the sky had fallen on his head. Did you not know that? Well, I spared you the details. You have to, I did edit it slightly. I thought, I'll leave that, it's worse when you leave it to your imagination, isn't it, than to get. It does happen, I'm afraid.
I'm sorry, it's I didn't write the book.
There is a moral to the tale. And that's where the end, that's where it is, and Eric might pick. But there is a warning here, isn't there, about getting, be careful who you listen to and getting caught up in fear. And just because something falls on your head, it doesn't mean it's the end of the world. Acorns, are you all right? You're tired, aren't you? Acorns fall on, somewhere, an acorn will fall on someone's head today. It doesn't mean it's the end of the world as we know it. To use another one of their songs, actually. Which we've, that's the story, I'm afraid, for this morning. I hope it's revealed an awful lot about some of us that we didn't know about, did we? It has revealed more than I was expecting it to. There is great breadth and depth, and also.
But here's an.
I'm going to invite you to sing a song in a minute, and it's a favourite song of mine, and it's a favourite song of my congregation's, and it is a favourite song of a particular member of my congregation who sadly, very recently died. And I'm conducting a funeral not long after I get back from here. I'm going to be writing it probably this afternoon, actually. Now, Liz definitely found her religion amongst us. She definitely did. And her daughter said to me just the other day that she found great healing amongst us. That's the phrase she used. So, and she'd a person who had struggled to feel accepted all of her life. For various reasons and in all communities she'd been of. And she used to say to me, so that's okay here. I've never been to a church like this before. She did also say, I'd never met a minister like you before. Well, and I'm going to see Bill Darlison on Saturday for his wonderful golden, and he's probably the last time I get to see Bill, actually. And he once said to me, Danny, nobody's met a minister like you before. Which I'm not sure how to take, but that's very Bill. But let's sing. And if you want to leave round, have a read of you. You're interested in chicken licking now, aren't you? Ezra. So we're going to sing, and we're going to really sing, aren't we? And sing it for Liz and for all those that found a home amongst us and found healing. What a thing to say. Hymn number 68. I dream of a church, 68.
I dream of a church that joins in with God's laughing as she rocks in her rapture, enjoying her art. She's glad of a world in its risking and growing. 'Tis a child she has borne and holds close to her heart. I dream of a church that joins in with God's weeping as she crouches way down by the sorrow she sees. She cries for the hostile, the cold, and no hope in. But she bears in herself our despair and disease. I dream of a church that joins in with God's dancing as she moves like the wind and the wave and the fire. A church that can pick up its skirts pirouetting with the steps that can signal God's deepest desire. I dream of a church that joins in with God's loving as she bends to embrace the unlovely and lost. A church that can free back its sharing and daring, the imprisoned and poor, and then shoulder the cost. God, make us a church that joins in with your living, as you cherish and challenge, rein in and release. A church that is winsome, impassioned, inspiring, like an nest of your justice and lamb of your peace.
Thank you all. Gosh, how on earth am I going to follow that? Okay. The sky may not be falling down. We've already established that. But What do you do when you convince yourself that this sky is indeed falling down because an acorn landed on your head? I will tell you about my own test. I call it a twofold test of a good religion. And it's a simplified and imperfect test, and one that I think you should take with a pinch of salt. But it goes as follows. Can you joke about this religion? And does it help you when... The saying goes something along the lines, when the solid waste gets closer to the fan? Right? Or perhaps, paraphrasing the famous words of Adele's song, does it help you when the sky falls, when it crumbles, will you stand tall and face it all together? Well, of course, my twofold test of a good religion is not a perfect indicator by any stretch of the imagination. And in reality, religion is something that should be continuously examined. How does it shape how you see the world? In what ways does it shape the world around you? How does it compel you to act in the world? Does it help you to stay sane so that you don't have the tendency to fall for unchecked information, every single ridiculous conspiracy theory or the latest fad, just because an acorn landed on your head? You have probably heard numerous times in Unitarian circles a variation of, it's not so much what you believe in, it's what those beliefs do to you. Have you? Another one for the bingo. James Luther Adams, who was one of the greatest 20th century Unitarian theologians, once said, here's the quote, "An unexamined faith is not worth having, for it can only be true by accident. A faith worth having is a faith worth discussing and testing." And I think that nothing in this religion should be exempt from scrutiny of reason. No idea, no doctrine. So the ultimate test of a good religion will always be an unfinished business. Always work in progress as the world around us changes, as our context changes, as our thinking and our philosophy, collective philosophy, evolves. But as a mental shorthand, I do find myself saying to people who approach me, both in my congregational ministry and in my online ministry, and say something like, Arek, I became fascinated by the idea of X, Y, and Z. What do you think about it? And I say to them, what is it? Are you able to joke about it? Would it help you when everybody, when the sky falls, when it crumbles, will you stand tall and hold it all together, or face it all together even? Well, in fact, I've got a third point as well, but the third point is, how would your religion react if aliens landed on Earth? I think it's quite a fun exercise to do, but that's beside it. If the answer to those two questions, can you joke about it, will it help you when the sky falls, is yes, go ahead. Entertain it for a while, be playful with it. Joke about it, because those jokes, humor, will help you highlight the holes in the idea, or the doctrine, or the religion you are examining. You know, it strips off the pathos and the veil of sacredness. It exposes gaps. Humor can actually be a fantastic tool for testing ideas. And then, begin to examine it thoroughly. Begin the work of lifelong examining. So here's my story. And I've told this story before, a bunch of times actually, so if you've heard it before, I am sorry. But as the King Henry VIII said to his wives, I will not keep you long. Someone said that I should be writing those Christmas cracker jokes, right? I grew up Roman Catholic in Poland, in the 90s and the noughties, which basically means that you had about as much chance of being anything else than a Roman Catholic as you had of being hit by lightning. And yeah, I left the church when I was an older teenager, and I won't bore you with all the reasons for it. You can probably think of some of them anyway. And those of you who were in my and Danny's group this week, you've heard some of it. But this talk isn't about it. It's not about theological points I disagreed with, or even about even the smallest traces of what you may call religious trauma. It's not about some sort of dramatic exit. It's just that at some point, I lost my religion. And if that wasn't enough, pretty soon after, I lost my country too, because I've moved from Poland to the UK. But I didn't plan that part. I kind of tripped and fell into this country by accident. It's another long story. Buy me a pint and I'll tell you. But I promise it's not that exciting. There are no dragons and no chicken licking or goosey loosey in this story. But here's the thing. Losing my religion. This may sound dramatic, doesn't it? Losing my religion. It didn't wreck me. It wasn't painful. It wasn't sad. In fact, it felt awesome. Like I'd been holding my breath underwater for years and suddenly I got pulled up again. Sure, there was some pain prior to that, you know, in realizing that I didn't belong in the place, in the church to which I'd been assigned at my infant baptism, or even that there was some hurt for me being there. It took some time, some painful reckoning for me to finally realize I didn't need religion. Religion didn't need me. Finally losing it was like dropping a brick from my pocket. Nay, letting a fat boulder slip out from your backpack. And once I actually dropped it, oh boy, what a relief. The dead weight came off. The door to all things bright and beautiful swung open, and I ran for my life into the big, wide, and beautiful world, free from religion, superstition, and all that nonsense. I didn't just become an atheist. I went full-on anti-theist, a free man of the land of no religion. I was convinced that religion was the source of all evil, all of it. Whatever fairy tale you were reading in your silly little book club that meets in some oddly shaped, impractical building where your bosses wear some funny hats, I thought you were wasting your time, and worse, you were probably doing some serious damage while you were at it. And you know what? I needed the angry face. I needed to purge. I'm not proud of the things I said about religions or how I looked down upon with contempt at religious people. But in the long run, I needed that time. And don't think that you lot got some special treatment just because you are Unitarians. Your religion was rubbish too. Even though I'd never heard of it. But by the virtue of being religion, surely it was, end of. But then, over time, little cracks started to show in my nice, neat, religion is bad wall that kept me happy, and I had picked through those cracks. I did it on my long, solitary walks in nature, which I did sometimes in silence, but more often listening to music. And at first, it was popular music. And then somehow, I started to listen to Christian music that I'd grown up with, because some residue of it stayed with me. And strangely enough, years after leaving all that religious nonsense for good, it started seeping back through those cracks, through music. Gregorian chant, Teze song, old organ pieces, hymn tunes, and it felt weirdly comforting. Now, of course, I wouldn't tell anyone. This was back when your music app might randomly broadcast to your Facebook friends what you were listening to. Remember that? Remember? And in fact, well, everything you did was broadcasted to everybody. Your Facebook friend is listening to Rihanna's new album on Spotify. Oh, wow, he's cool. Unlike me with my cringe-worthy church music. So I'd check 10 times to make sure that my settings were all on private, because God forbid anybody saw Arek is listening to Veni Creator Spiritus by Gregorian Monks on Spotify. There was a war going on inside of me. Deep down, I knew that I was praying on those walks, but I refused to call it that. I told myself I was just thinking about stuff. I knew I was meditating, but I rebranded it as daydreaming. Because letting myself admit otherwise that I was actually beginning to practice all that weird woo-woo stuff, that was even scarier than letting my Facebook friends on my dark little musical secret. And for some time, I was perfectly happy with this nondescript, amorphous religion I engaged with on my walks. The start of my turn to God or religion, after being not only not interested, but also greatly cynical about it. In that religion that I began to create, there were no doctrinal statements, no 39 articles, no 12 steps, no 10 commandments, no 7 principles, no 3 divine persons, not even any one single golden rule. Just me, maybe God, I wasn't sure about that, and whatever the heck happened to be playing on my headphones. My playlist expanded to also include Zen music and Madonna, Sick Chants and the Beach Boys. You get the idea. There was no rhyme and reason to what was in, what was out in my newly forming religion. I was basically cobbling my theology together through songs completely on vibes. If it moved me, if it hit that weird dopamine switch in my brain, it was sacred, no questions asked. And I was happy with this religion of mine. After a while, it got lonely. It turns out, when your entire faith community is just you, your headphones, and maybe God, if you are into that sort of thing, you start to question your sanity. So I wanted people, but oh boy, was I picky. Those people needed to be open-minded enough not to ridicule me the second they got a chance, but also clear-headed enough to tell me when I take this whole spiritual thing a step too far. Right, we're going to get a little bit heady now. There is a term in the sociological study of religion coined by a theologian and philosopher, Peter Berger, called plausibility structure. And plausibility structures are the contexts for systems of meaning, like religions, in which meanings make sense or are made plausible, easier to believe. Beliefs, meanings held by individuals and groups are supported by and embedded in our socio-cultural institutions and processes. So in other words, I wanted a place, even though I didn't have that language, a community, my own structure of plausibility, where my patchwork faith would just make sense. But a community that would also keep me in check to make sure that my newly found religion that I began to stitch together from random scraps of what people may call the fragments of holiness, have you got that book? Does not turn out to be a Frankenstein monster. And then, in another series of unfortunate events, I came across Unitarianism. And the rest is history, as they say. Now, I was lucky enough that the community I found, and I was in Leeds, don't get too headed about it, too big-headed about it, not only met the criteria of that, of plausibility structure, but also seemed to live by what I now call my twofold test of a good religion. Does anybody remember what it is? Can you joke about it? Does it help you when? When the sky falls, when it crumbles. No, they never said those words out loud. They certainly didn't sing it. It's not like it was on a poster or in a wayside pulpit. It wasn't in the constitution of the charity or anything. But looking back, I can tell that it was there. And thank God, or fate, or dumb luck, that I found that place before the first acorn smacked me on my head. Because when it did, I wasn't drawn into blind panic and fear and ended up down a fox of sorts. So how did I find my way back to religion that used to make me cringe so badly? One of the songs that snuck its way into my spiritual walking playlist was Billy Joel's River of Dreams. You know, the one, in the middle of the night, I go walking in my sleep. The lyrics go like this. Through the jungle of doubt to a river so deep, I know I'm searching for something, something so undefined that it can only be seen by the eyes of the blind in the middle of the night. Those words stuck. Years later, they even made it onto my application for ministry training. And later, onto the cover letter when I applied for the post I hold now with Leicester Unitarians. It turns out that searching was where I felt most at home, the very act of it. But still, there were some well-known to me paths that no matter how far I'd wandered, I kept coming back to. So when I first landed amongst Unitarians, I was very much what people call an ABC Unitarian. Have we heard that? Anything but Christianity? And our movement gave me a space for that. And I thank you, our movement, for that. A safe room where I could slam the door on anything that smelt like my old religion, chuck out the theology that to me didn't hold water, and to rage clean my spiritual cupboards. And honestly, what a gift it was. Everyone needs somewhere where they can detox from a religion that caused hurt without people shoving it back at you like leftovers that you didn't want in the first place. But here's my nudge to those of you who may still be in your old religion cringe, whatever that might be. At some point, when you feel ready, take whatever religion you've got stuffed in the closet, dust it off, have another look. If there's anything worth keeping, keep it. Maybe your understanding has shifted. Maybe time has given you new eyes or enough distance. Or perhaps people who were force-feeding you aren't around anymore. And if you still hate it, fine. Back to the closet it goes. But at least you know what it is if life goes sideways and you suddenly need its structure. Which brings me to the second part of my twofold test of a good religion. Will it help you when the sky falls? Here's where my double life comes in. By day, I'm a minister. By night, and some ungodly mornings, I'm a group fitness instructor. And I got into it during one of the lowest seasons of my life because apparently some people get tattoos when they are hurting. I got those too. And I also signed up for some mad classes, so I must have been really hurting. And yeah, it turns out there is a reason why people show up to the gym when the lies are in pieces. And it's actually a well-documented phenomenon. That room, that studio with blasting music, sweaty strangers, dim lights, and someone yelling, "Three more reps and you'll feel incredible!" That became my church. The people were my congregation. The instructor was my pastor with her transcendent weight bar. That plyometric lunge. Let's just say that was a sacrament. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but in those classes, something happens. You move your body so hard that your brain finally shuts up. When I was at uni, I researched literature that links sports and spirituality, and I also interviewed my own class participants. And I remember that in doing so, I came across a quote in Rainer Raphael's book, The Gospel of Wellness, came out in 2023, I think, that essentially captured this experience that I and many of those I spoke to shared. And I want to read you the quote from Raphael's book. She wrote, "I can shut out the world and my own thoughts for a while, that's at the gym. You don't have time to fathom if you potentially chose the wrong career. You are jumping so hard that your shitty ex melts into the abyss. Nothing else exists, for you have one task and one task only, complete the burpee. You are, for once, present." The heightened emotional experience which occurs during group exercise, fueled by adrenaline and endorphin rush, often leads to participants to confide to the fitness pastors. My class attendees have spoken to me about poor mental health and self-harm and relationship problems and illness in family and addiction and bereavement. And admittedly, as someone who started my group exercise journey at his one of the lowest points in life, I cannot deny its salvific qualities. It would not be an exaggeration to say that gym kept me going when I was prepared to give up. But I also must be honest and admit that it was more of a patch and dispatch kind of solution and not a long-term solution. For a while, it saved me. But here's the catch. The gym, or any kind of commodified wellness, spa retreats, retail therapy, tattoo therapy, gym membership, is great for keeping you alive or keeping you together, but not so much for helping you live. It doesn't have centuries of ritual and stories and traditions to help you mark your losses and celebrate your milestones or infuse your life with meaning. Your fitness pastor might be inspiring, but they are probably not trained to walk with you through grief or doubt or joy that's too big to name. A good religion doesn't just distract you from the sky falling down, or doesn't just help you dodge the acorn, it helps you look up and face it when the sky falls, when it crumbles. It can give you tools to help you navigate it. So here's the thing about my little twofold test. If religion, if all it does, it keeps you from noticing the sky falling, it's not worth much. I don't want something that hands me noise-cancelling headphones when the ceiling caves in. I want something that will stand next to me, tilt my chin upward, and say, yep, the sky's falling, let's deal with it. A good religion hands you the tools to navigate the rubble without pretending that it's confetti. Which is why I side-eye commodified wellness that basically set up camps in the lives of so many formerly religious folks. And I mean, God bless Pilates, meditation app, or essential oils. But the hurting people I talked to after my gym classes weren't looking for tips on how to perfect the burpee or the down dog. They weren't craving motivational posters that say you can be anything you want, while their lives were slowly burning down. Even when the conversation started, because we were all sweaty and pumped on endorphins, it always, and I mean it, inevitably veered, not because I was doing it, towards something deeper, something more religious, honestly. Story retelling that meant something. Sense making that tapped into our shared cultural bones. And somewhere along this line, I'd realized that religion that I thought I outgrown, it's still mine. It still works on me. It still holds tools I can use. It still tells stories that feel like home, even if I've rearranged the furniture. And there is a story in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, chapter 28. It's a story of a dream that wandering Jacob had in a place called Bethel. Now, Bethel means the house of God. Beth comes from Beit, which means house in Hebrew, and El, God. So Bethel, house of God. And I would like to read that fragment from the book of Genesis here. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran. He came to a certain place and stayed there for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he dreamed that there was a stairway up on the earth, the top of it reaching to heaven. And angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And the Lord stood beside him and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. Know that I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will not leave you. Then Jacob woke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, Bethel. This is the gate of heaven. Now, I'm bringing my segment into a close, but I would like to tell you about one hymn, the hymn that we will sing at the end of this theme talk, which was inspired by the piece of scripture that we've heard. It's one of the greatest Unitarian hymns, in my humble opinion, one that we don't sing often enough, written by a Unitarian, Sarah Flower Adams, in 1841, and a tune was composed by an organist who at least played in a Unitarian church, Lowell Mason. You know, we've got this habit of claiming anybody who ever stepped into a Unitarian church. That's the case. Do you know what hymn it is? Nearer, my God, to thee. Nearer to thee. The words go, even though it be a cross that raiseth me, even though it be that old religion of mine that raiseth me, nearer, my God, to thee. And then as we were planning this talk, Danny and I, Danny sends me an email with outline of what, you know, the sort of order of service of what we're going to be doing. And I about died laughing, and I had to rewrite the end of the end of my talk. Because Danny writes in an email, hymn, instead of nearer my God to thee, it said, nearer thy God to me. And you know what? Danny's right. God is, and always has been to me, relational. If we are getting nearer, it's because the God you relate to is closing the distance too. There let the way appear, steps down from heaven. Angels to beckon me, nearer thy God to me. Not where I think I should be, nearer to me. Not where I'm pretending to be, but here, now, nearer to me, nearer thy God to me. Amen. We will hear some music now, and just to clarify, this is a kind of filler music, so feel free to, you can actively listen to it, but feel free to chat amongst yourselves or stretch as Danny and I change places. Thank you all.
This is the end. Hold your breath and count to ten. Feel the earth move and then hear my heart burst again. For this is the end. I've drowned and dreamt this moment. So overdue I owe day. Swept away I'm stolen. Hit the sky fall.
Back to me then. Nearer thy God to me, apparently. There you go. I am very famous for my typing errors, or infamous, so there you go. I'm better known for my mistakes.
There's some good theology,
then. Well, clearly, yeah. Clearly. A dear friend used to love pointing them out to me, sadly no longer with us, but a dear, dear friend. I'm going to begin by sharing a section from this tatty old book. It's my fifth version of this book, so if you'd seen the original one, it would be absolute. It's fallen apart more than I am. But it's the book is Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And it's taken from the fourth chapter, We Agnostics, page 55. And the very, very first service of worship I ever conducted at Cross Street Chapel over 18 years ago, I read a slightly longer section of this. So it's kind of where my ministry journey began. And my life journey in so many ways began. So it's just two paragraphs, that's all. It kind of set me up. I'll talk a little more about it later. So here we go. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself. Then, if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. Now, of course, it was written in 1939, so the language, some of it, would be considered a little old-fashioned now, but quite impactful. I'll come back to a bit more of that later. Now, I recently came across a term that's new to me. I'm sure some of the smart amongst you, it won't be new to you. And the term is anatheism. Any familiar with it, some of you?
Yeah.
Anatheism. A-N-A and then theism, yeah? Some of you have been smarter than I know about this one. It's a term coined by the philosopher Richard Kearney. It describes an experience of rediscovering the divine having previously rejected God and religion. We just heard about it, actually, I think. In my mind, a form of reconstruction, Eric, something that we ourselves are exploring in our group this week. Exactly that, isn't it? Celebrating doubt whilst engaging with the sacred in more open and questioning ways. So the God that it's kind of talking about or introducing to us is new and personal to each individual.
not prescribed. It's a new experience, but you've got to have gone through the other experience to get there, I guess. I think that sounds like what we're doing here. Sounds like what we do at our best in our communities, I think. Certainly what's at the heart of 12-step fellowships, in my experience. Certainly what I've been through. And, yeah, you're a great example of it, I think. Hi, I don't like labels, but I'm going to give myself a label. My name is Danny, and I am an anatheist, and I don't think I'm alone. I was not brought up in a religious home, similar to what Jane was talking about. The people I grew up with would have said they were Christians, but only in the same way of saying they were British, probably. Probably meant it's about the same thing, really. Without being rude, there was no real sign of it, and we were not in a religious family. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of shame. There was violence, and there was fear of violence, and I woke every morning frightened. The world was considered a frightening place. It was kind of, when I read Thomas Hobbes at university, I thought, oh man, that's the idea that I grew up in of the world, and that I needed to be tough and hard to survive, that the person I was could not live in this world. Someone like me, and I can still feel like that. Something about me had to be different just to live in this world. I'm a nice kid, but you're not suitable for this world. So that's what I grew up believing. But it wasn't imposed by religious ideas. They were not religious. They were just the way that the world was seen and the way that the world was actually for all of us. So I didn't grow up religious. Was I anti-religious? I just didn't, like Jane talked about, I didn't really think about it. Well, I probably thought about it, but it didn't mean anything to me. It was just a bit silly. It's probably how I saw it. And interestingly, just like was said yesterday or the other day, but when I met people who were convinced atheists, again, the contrarian in me thought, well, no, I'm not like you either. Probably towards the end, actually, before I rediscovered things, I did become what you might call a nihilist. I believed in nothing, sadly. As many of you know, I grew up in the village of Bursal, or Bustal, if you're from there. Infamous, sadly, now for other things. And in the market square is this great statue of Joseph Priestley, which looked nothing like that picture in Mill Hill Chapel. This towering figure in the market square where we would go and congregate and drink Thunderbirds and hopefully, if we were lucky, meet a girl, but it didn't really work out. Not that one we mentioned earlier. Priestley was one of the leading figures, maybe, of British and American Unitarianism. But we just knew him as a famous scientist, you know, the discoverer of oxygen, or you explained it really well, didn't you, Ned, the other day? Or the one who invented soda water, or as we would say, the man who invented oxygen. Didn't exist apparently before him. Yeah. But Ned can explain all that to you. But my life, though, it had nothing to do with it really, but it's just part of my roots, and I like it actually. But my life for 20 years was primarily centered about the need to escape, to not be here. And it didn't go very well. But that began to change in somewhere between 2002 and 2004, and as things changed within me, not the world, brought on by my acceptance and journey into recovery, acceptance of alcoholism and addiction and journey into recovery, and somewhere in all that, something happened to me, which I'll never be able to explain, but it happened. It was an experience that has continued. And I believe, nearer I got to me, that something happened. That's what I believe now. But I didn't know what the heck was going on. I really was blown away. It was overwhelming. But it was real. It wasn't that I was just going mad,
although some people probably thought I was. And as a result of that, I then became interested in religion because I thought, well, maybe these people talk about this kind of stuff. I will explore. And I discovered Unitarianism by mistake, you could say, but by the, and I think a few people have discovered it by this. Some, there's an American website, or it was in those days, called beliefnet.com, and a mate of mine used to go on it, and he pointed me to it, and I took the quiz, Belief-O-Matic, and it said I was 100% Unitarian Universalist.
And I won for the bingo.
There you go. But it's real. It's what it is exactly what happened to me, and of course I did the thing, the book. What's that? I was 99% Quaker as well, really. But I thought, well, I know them, they're nice. I've been to the Quakers actually a few times. I like it, but I feel a bit frustrated. I mean, like I need to do something because I'm not the quiet person. Well, I am, but I also need to move and make a bit of noise occasionally. So I turned up at Cross Street Chapel, and that's where it all went right or wrong. I'm not sure, depending on your perspective. But I found that church we sang about. I found that church that Liz dreamed about, that she found. The point of religion to build communities of love that encourage the search for understanding, for meaning beyond the confines of our limited, limited individual selves. Because we can only see a little. And we don't know if it, and we might be just fooling ourselves, yeah? Beyond the confines of mine or anybody's understanding, to journey together in a fellowship of love. I love the roof at Dunham Road. It's like a ship. Anybody who's been there, just look up. Don't listen to me. Look up over the ceiling. That's all you've got to do. That we journey, and it's always Groundhog Day, you know. Groundhog Day is the most spiritual film ever made because you're just repeating the same day, but something slightly different happens, and something is experienced differently. It's also quite funny. And I quite like Andy McDowell, but don't tell anybody. But it changes you somewhere inside, and that is the spiritual journey, which is done in a day. I always get frustrated when people say it's a daily journey, you know. Goes, well, that's what a journey is, what you do in a day, isn't it? You know that, you're French. Just means what you do in a day. That's a journey. It's not complicated, and yet we talk about what you do in a day. So every day is a journey, literal. But it's beautiful, and you don't go anywhere. And it brings to my mind that beautiful, beautiful, tiny little poem by Wendell Berry, that farmer poet. He's a farmer and a little bit of a poet. And it's a really short one, inspired by Meister Eckhart, his spiritual journey. And the world cannot be discovered by a journey of miles, no matter how long, but only by a spiritual journey of 1 inch. Very arduous and humbling and joyful, by which we arrive at the ground at our feet and learn to be at home. It's the journey under the skin that we live in. To be at home in who we are. Shake off our shoes. This is holy ground. So is our skin. They're telling me it's in the trees. It's inside me. Tell me to visualize. It's inside me. I don't need to go anywhere. Just need to know that. It's inside me. It has been found. My journey began and continued in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the heart. That's what we were exploring yesterday. It's the heart of the matter. A friend of mine recently sent me a sermon that was preached 6 months after that book came out, on the 26th of November in 1939, by Dilworth Lupton. Anybody know who Dilworth Lupton was? Reverend Dilworth Lupton. Well, he was the minister at the First Unitarian Church in Cleveland, Ohio. Joe Cherry, anybody know Joe Cherry? Yeah, lovely guy. Well, he, when I was training for the ministry, he spent a few months in England and did a short placement at Duckingfield Old Chapel, Clare's Church. And I got to know him then. Well, he remained a friend of mine, and he was the minister at this church a few years ago. And he told me that Alcoholics Anonymous began in his church. And that the people in Cleveland Heights do believe that. It's not quite true, actually, but but it was the first place where they actually used the word, the name. But they had meetings before that, but they were connected to the Oxford groups, but they left those of the day. And they were, so they were the first ones to use that name. And Dilworth Lupton played a major role, actually, in the town. And this sermon that my friend recently discovered was turned into a pamphlet and was published in the local newspapers. And he was a hugely important person. And it was in Cleveland, Ohio, where it really exploded and grew massively. And Dilworth Lupton played an important role in that. So I thought I'd share some thoughts from Dilworth, because I thought it was important to me and to us, really, and about our religion and what these folk were about and what he noticed then that remains today. He noted four principal aspects of their membership and their fellowship. The first, being spiritual dependence on something beyond your mere human will. But what impressed Lupton was that this was not prescribed to them, but for each individual to make sense of themselves. The second being universality, that the groups were open to anybody, regardless of belief or lack of belief. He used the phrase near atheist and near agnostic. I'm not quite sure what he meant, but just an interesting phrase that Dilworth was talking about. The third being mutual aid, that they truly were a fellowship of people who gave of themselves to help one another and those who still struggled. And finally, the principle of transformation, that something was happening in the lives of these people that not only dispelled the obsession with alcohol, but it transformed their lives. Something happened. And towards the end of the sermon, he offers these people some advice. He wrote a lot more, but I thought this was funny. And he also noticed there was a lot of humour there, and there still is. It's gallows humour, and it's gallows humour because there's definitely a gallows for these people. But they were funny. And they told these horrific stories, and everybody laughed, and they were laughing at each other. But he wrote this. One final word to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go back to your synagogues and churches. They need you and you need them. Preserve your principle of universality, your faith that all religion is one. Never allow yourselves to be absorbed by any church or sect. Keep your movement, what you call it now, a layman's outfit. Avoid over-organization, for religious organizations always tend to follow the letter rather than the spirit, finally crushing the spirit. Remember that early Christianity was promoted not by highly involved organization, but by the contagion of souls fired with enthusiasm for their cause. And keep your sense of humor. So far, you do not seem afflicted with the curse of over-seriousness. Despite the seriousness of what they were dealing with, it was too serious to be taken too seriously. And there is a rule that developed called Rule 62. And I have got one of these on my car. There isn't any other rule. The rule 1 to 61 doesn't exist, but the Rule 62 is. I know, that's the joke. But the rule is, don't take yourself so darn seriously. It was a slightly different word to that. Don't take yourself. Or as I like to say, have a laugh. Earlier I shared a piece of literature from the chapter We Agnostics. And it suggests how each person might find the power that they seek to let go completely, like we did on Saturday, of any previous ideas. I know it's because summer school's been moved around, it's confusing. Prejudices that you may have, and search within yourself. Ask yourself what it might mean to you. Not anybody else. Examine yourself. Which is good news for most people, but not for everybody. It's a powerful, beautiful message, unless, of course, you believe, as many people do, that at the core of your humanity, there is something fundamentally wrong. So it's not good news then, is it? That's the last place on earth I want to go near. And that was my problem. As it is for so many. That there is a great love at the core of life, but also of you. So it was suggested to me when I really struggled with this bit. I struggled with lots of it, if I'm honest, but anyway, but we got there. But this bit. So I spent a few weeks reflecting on this, and there was a little boy who was in my life, who was 3 years old at the time. And what I saw in him, I see in her, she's the same age, exactly the same age now. And somewhere in that, my reason, I also was going to each lunchtime at work, I was going to a local Catholic church, and there was the image of the statue of the Sacred Heart image. And I meditated on that too. Theologically incorrect what I got to, but what I saw was that Sacred Heart in Jesus, the Sacred Heart in this little boy, this little passage, well, maybe that's in me then. That's all it was to begin with. And that's never gone. It awakened something in me. A blessing, I guess. And it's remained ever since through what has ever happened, and as those that know me, that little boy died sadly 3 years later, but what awakened in me did not go back to sleep. I just want to share a rather lovely piece by Barbara Pesk, and she wrote one of those lovely little meditation books that you people produce, and this is from Morning Watch. She wrote, "We spend so much time running from ourselves, fleeing from what we know about the goodness in our hearts, we think we can escape the intelligence of our loving. Imagine you are standing before a Bodhisattva, Jesus, Buddha, the First Mother, it does not matter what you call the Holy One. He has dust on his shoes, chaff clings to her. The smells of being alive shining from their faces is the beam of all their questions, the compassion of their living. Can you see yourself through those eyes? Can we know each other like this? We who no longer believe in messiahs can hardly believe in each other. Can we know ourselves seen and know each other this same way until our restless hearts learn to abide in this knowing and this love? Can we live in this gaze of blessing? Can we learn to live in this gaze of blessing? Can we gaze at the world and one another and see blessing? Can we?" I'm going to read a bit of Genesis now. Right back to the beginning of Genesis, the first book of Genesis, verse 27. "God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." So not gods, but formed in the image, a reflection, a divine reflection with a responsibility to life, to each other and ourselves. Original blessing is what they call it, don't they? And if we can live by that then and apply the golden rule, we have to live by that and apply the golden rule, not from what I used to think. For the golden rule to be of value, you have to believe that though. And then treat them as they should be. But of course, the second book of Genesis and the fall and eating the forbidden fruit, people believe that we're born, that there's something fundamentally wrong with us. I believe that, even though I didn't believe in the religion of it, I believed in the belief of it without the religion, which is probably worse, more dangerous, more destructive. Although that kind of stuff does explain some of our troubles, and it's an easy explanation for what's wrong in the world, isn't it? If we believe, oh, well, that's easy then. No responsibility, just let it go. But that changed in me. So when we look at one another, do we see someone made of that same flesh and spirit that is in them? It's inside me. It has been found. Do we believe that? Do we recognize that in ourselves and one another? So What is my religion? What is the heart of my faith? It's blessing. That's it. It's simple. Every Sunday morning and everything I do, I end with this thought that we need to bless more, that we can all bless. And we bless each other by giving ourselves wholeheartedly to life in all that we feel, in all that we think, in all that we say, and in all that we do. But we have to believe it first. Otherwise we won't. I found blessing is the heart of my religion that I have found. Liz found that too. She had struggled all her life with a sense of being wrong, of being unacceptable. Foundationally, from birth, she was told that. And she found, at the end of her life, healing in a place full of misfits and weirdos. Sorry, those that attended Umbrella Chapel, but anyway. And she was blessed by it, and she was a blessing to it, really. Grounded in reality. Grounded in love. And I found it in a bunch of people that were as broken as people could be, and they found that in them. And maybe it helped sometimes to be broken open, I don't know. And so did our forebears, really, because that's at the heart of our religion. By rejecting original sin, the rest of it comes. But it's not that they rejected it, but they see what came before it. Original blessing is what Matthew Fox called it. And then the human of Jesus is an example. Not that any of us live up to it, but it's a potential. It was this belief in this potential in us, that we have a capacity. We have that capacity. And we have to believe it about ourselves and everybody else, or we are the fan and all that business. We are. We're in a right mess. Well, we are, maybe. But then the acorns have always been falling on our heads, haven't they? There's not a day goes by when an acorn doesn't fall on someone's head. It doesn't mean the world's coming to an end. I found my religion. It's grounded in reality. It's grounded in this world. It is of blessing. Yes, it began by rejecting old ideas, but that went years ago. It came to a point where it was almost nearly over. I found it with a bunch of people who couldn't be more broken, but they loved, they cared. They showed me a way. The most broken people in earth, maybe. Mutual suffering, and they inspired me to look within me and find what was actually, to see the truth about my humanity and everybody else's too. And from there, a blessing was born. It awakened in me what is at the core of life and the core of each of our frail humanity. It enabled me to be a blessing and sometimes even to receive a blessing. But that can be quite tough for someone like me still. There's a few cracks still need opening to bring love alive. I found my religion, a new religion, a journey from nothing to everything, a new faith. Anatheism's the word for those smart people. So my name is Danny, and I'm an anatheist, and you probably are too, maybe. That'll do. Thanks.
And so now we would like to invite you to take some time and write a prayer in on those post-it notes. And if I may suggest, you can write whatever prayer you wish, but if I may suggest one of the two following types of prayers, either a blessing that you want to share with the world or with yourself, blessing for you, blessing for your community, blessing for the wider world, or perhaps a prayer that brings thy God nearer to thee. So we're going to have just some time to reflect on that, and then we'll bring it to a conclusion. Let us join in a time of prayer, reflection, or mindful attention. With words slightly adapted of a Polish Yiddish poet, Kadia Molodowski. All that examining, and I still don't know to whom. I still don't know why I ask. A prayer lies bound in me and implores a God and asks for a name. I pray in the field, in the noise of the street, together with the wind when it runs before my lips. A prayer lies bound in me and asks for a God and asks for a name. I pray to create a God that looks like me. I bless this wild world. Bless this caring community. Bless those friendships for the roads. Bless you, bless me, bless us. Blessing of the trees and the stars, this crowd of sacred hearts, so that we come to be a blessing for the world. Blessing for those who feel sometimes so alone, struggling with doubts, fears, and overwhelming grief. Blessing on our hearts. May we be broken open to be able to see and receive the truth of who we are, so that we can share the gifts that only we can give. Turn up the volume on the earphones, I think it says, and invite the blessing of every day. Let's honor that divine spark in each of us and evolve in all of existence. Blessed are those who do not believe and act in love anyway. One from me. Blessed are those who laugh at themselves, for they shall never cease to be amused. Good morning and welcome to all you wonderful gifts of life itself. May we believe that within us all there is a place of love. From the lips of the broken is heard profound
from the lips of the broken is heard profound truth. God, or good, spirit, love, holds them in a quiet, ever-present way.
Gosh, bless you. Thank you.
and I found one that I think would be very appropriate to close this time of prayer together. The rest will be displayed on the wall. A nice segue to the hymn that we are about to sing. God of my heart, be near me when it feels like the sky is falling in. Keep me to not take myself too seriously. Amen to all of those. And so I invite you to join us as we sing our closing hymn. Now this is in the red hymnal. And that's hymn number 360. So that's all the way around, 360. Full circle. We've gone full circle. Nearer, my God, to thee. Let's rise as we are able. I can tell it's one of our favourite hymns. If I could, I would have it in every Sunday service that we do in Leicester, but I hold my horses. I want to share with you the simplest blessing I know.
And some people in my congregation know that when I share it with them, that means I forgot to write my benediction for the close of the service. And that blessing are the words of Mary Oliver. Love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. Amen.
Amen.